From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. President Trump says he's open to improving the federal background check system for gun purchases. His statement this morning came after a weekend of blistering criticism from students who survived last week's deadly school shooting in Florida. Here's Emma Gonzalez yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
This is our opportunity to talk to President Trump, Governor Rick Scott, and State Senator Marco Rubio to make sure that they know we are talking directly to them and all other members of the United States government that are being funded by the NRA to tell them now is the time to get on the right side of this.
The president also plans to hold a listening session on Wednesday with students and teachers from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Joining us now, NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. He's got more on this. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there, Meghna.
So what do you make of the president's statement this morning about background checks?
Well, you know, the bill that that he's saying that he's coming out in favor for, working with Senator John Cornyn of Texas and also Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, is more of a bill that kind of makes tweaks to the current system. In other words, holding some of these government agencies accountable for not uploading relevant information to the federal background check system. So to sort of figure out a way to tighten that system. Now, that's clearly not as much as what most Democrats would want, of course. Trump, you know, it should be noted, had laid out his position in his book, The America We Deserve, in 2000, and he called out the NRA, writing that generally he does not support gun controls, but he said, quote, "I support the ban on assault weapons, and I also support a slightly longer waiting period to purchase a gun," which is fairly interesting considering today he tweeted that we should have a good and reflective President's Day.
Right.
But clearly he'd flip-flopped on this during the campaign and has strong support from the NRA and has not come out in support of the assault weapons ban.
Well, so we'll talk about assault weapons more in just a second, but let's spend another minute about talking about this exact bill and what the president has said he may throw his support behind. Because as you mentioned, it's a bipartisan bill in the Senate from Chris Murphy and John Cornyn. It was introduced, what, late last year, but hasn't made much progress. We should say that on the House side of things, at the end of last year, there was kind of a similar bill, right, that would have filled holes in the background check system. But that came along with a provision that would have allowed people with concealed carry licenses to use those licenses across state lines, which is what made it a tough fight in the Senate. So I guess what I'm saying is that it seems as if no change to the background system can pass all of Congress without some relaxations in other gun regulations.
Well, remember that after the 2013 Newtown, Connecticut shooting at the school there that killed 20 children, there were, you know, almost two dozen measures that Democrats pushed for, including that Toomey-Manchin bill to limit background checks. That nothing passed, right? I mean, it was filibustered by Republicans, every single item. That bill only got 54 votes, which of course is a majority, but not enough to overcome a filibuster. Trump tweeted yesterday that if Democrats wanted to do anything on gun control, then they should have done it when they controlled the White House and both chambers of Congress. But of course, that filibuster was in place and nothing was able to pass. And this time around, you're right, the devil is in those details. And, you know, we've seen the Senate and House not be able to get on board, not just on gun control, but on immigration, on health care. They know that this is something that there's some agreement to do something on, but nobody can figure out quite what.
Now, about this listening session that the president's going to hold, or says he's going to hold on Wednesday, do we know more about that? Which students, which teachers from the high school?
We don't know exactly who he's going to be meeting with. We know that he's meeting with students and teachers. We don't know from which school, but we do know that, you know, empathy is something that Trump has struggled with on a public stage. You know, you're not going to see him doing kind of what Barack Obama did and, you know, espousing, you know, greater hopes, or it's just not one of his strengths. So, and the White House knows this. White House aides know this, and they know that this is a more liberal area. And given the fact that you've had a lot of students already coming out strongly in support for Congress doing something more, they want to protect the president and have something that's more controlled. So it will be interesting to see how any of this goes, because we know that they tried to shelter the president already from some of these protests.
Hmm. Now, just we got a couple seconds to go, but are we at a turning point here for Republicans and gun legislation?
You know, it's not clear that this is going to be some big turning point. There's maybe a little bit of reflection, as Trump tweeted today, but not much going to happen on guns until candidates start to lose because of a lack of action on guns.
Domenico Montanaro, lead politics editor for NPR. Domenico, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, the conflict in Syria is getting more complicated. According to Syrian state media, pro-government forces will help fight the Turkish military, which is on the offensive in northwest Syria. They're there fighting the Kurds. That's because Turkey believes those Kurds are aligned with what it says is a terrorist movement inside of Turkey. BBC Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher is following this story. And Sebastian, how significant is this? I mean, that pro-Syrian government forces would join this fight?
I think the significance of that will be when we see it happen and how it's done. What was suggested was a deal between the government and the Kurdish militia there. This is not the Syrian army. This is probably a group called the National Defense Force, which is essentially local militias, which have been doing most of the real fighting on behalf of the Syrian government for some time in any case, would be moving in. Now, the big question is what they're moving in to do. It could be that they're there to help the Kurds fight off this big Turkish incursion. But underneath, it might be something different that's going on, which is that this area, which is controlled and has been controlled by the Kurds for a long time, it's a mainly Kurdish area in any case, but it may be a sort of deal whereby Syrian government reestablishes a foothold back in this area, which essentially makes it seem no longer a complete fiefdom of the Kurds, which could possibly satisfy the Turks to some extent. The Turks have essentially said that they will not allow the Kurds to establish a sort of mini state along their border. Now, the Turks launched their incursion a few weeks ago. They haven't got very far with it. There've been quite heavy losses on both sides. And it may be that this is a good moment for the Turks to take stock of what's going on, to feel perhaps they bitten off a little more than they can chew, and some face-saving deal can be done to show that, yes, their action has stopped the Kurds from establishing this border area, which is what the Turks say must happen, but with the government essentially stepping in with their involvement to make that look as if it's happened, though in reality, it isn't exactly what the Turks want. I mean, they have said time and time again they want to eliminate all Kurdish militia along this right. area. But I think that's a huge, huge ask for them.
Well, I'm just wondering how to view this from a U.S. perspective, because, of course, Turkey is a U.S. ally, but as are the Kurds. I mean, the Kurds have been helping United States forces fight ISIS in Syria. So what effect might this new sort of move of the chess pieces have?
Well, of course, that is a big issue. I mean, when the Turks went in, a big red flag went up about these two NATO allies, Turkey and the US, who've been working through proxy forces. Would they actually be directly confronting each other? Because, as I was saying, there's Turkish soldiers involved in this, and there are US soldiers on the ground in this area, not specifically in this area called Afrin, but a bit over to the east. You know, the Kurds have been supported internationally many times before in the Middle East.
Right.
And when it's come to the crunch, the outside forces supporting them have removed that support when it's put them potentially in confrontation with bigger powers. And I think the Kurds fear that that will happen again with the US. And I think the real concern about the US, perhaps, is there isn't a very clear idea what the US strategy is now in Syria. The administration essentially said that it is there to continue the battle against the Islamic State group to ensure that it can't reassert itself. The Russians, the Iranians have all said that they believe the US should pull out. They weren't invited by the Syrian government. The Syrian government, according to the Russians and Iranians, are the sovereign a nation there. And unless you've been invited by them at a certain point, you have to go. So there are all these elements of confrontation. proxy forces have been used for years by all these outside powers. The danger at the moment is after Islamic State was forced out of all the territory that it took, but in that void, the potential for direct confrontation between these powers is increasing. And this goes even wider than the Russians, the Iranians, the Turks, the US. We saw down in the south, which has been relatively quiet a week ago, that Israel was getting involved in a way that it hasn't before. One of its planes was shot down by the Syrian government. It then launched a much bigger offensive than it has so far within the country. And Israel's concern over Iran, Hezbollah, the Lebanese movement that Iran backs, moving closer and closer to its border, that it needs to do something about it. So these are, you know, I mean, this has been an appalling war in so many ways. And the Syrians, of course, have suffered most. But in a geopolitical sense, this is probably one of the most dangerous times that it has been.
Well, the BBC's Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, speaking to us from London. Sebastian, thank you so much.
Thank you, Megan.
In Olympic hockey today, the U.S. women's team is headed back to the title game after beating Finland 5-0 in a semifinal matchup. That means the U.S. will go for gold on Wednesday against Canada. Now, our next story is also about hockey, but played at a whole different level. It features an American who last March traveled to North Korea, all for the love of the sport, and made it back home. Karen Given from NPR's Only a Game has his story.
Alex Fraycon is a 30-year-old copywriter and musician living in the Twin Cities. It's hard to describe how much he enjoys playing hockey. Beer league, he calls it. So I figured I'd let him tell you. In song. If Minnesota Nice and hip-hop were to have a baby, and that baby really loved hockey, the result would be the beer league anthem.
People ask why I still skate. At bad rinks when it's real late. Like, every game you get one fan. It's either some dude's wife or a girlfriend.
Last March, Alex Fraycon took a plane to Pyongyang, North Korea, handed his passport over to his tour guide slash minders, and stayed for a week. How did he get such a crazy idea?
Yeah, that's a question, surprisingly enough, I get a lot. I was on the internet, specifically as on this website called Reddit.
Reddit is an online community. People post stories, rants, articles, and web pages they've come across.
And I saw this post that simply said, hey, who wants to come to North Korea to play hockey with me? And I thought to myself, okay, you know, that sounds interesting. Very clickbaity.
The link took Alex to a website for the How International Friendship League, a sports tourism organization based in Canada.
And I X'd out of the window and I didn't think anything of it. I didn't even consider going. It wasn't a thing that I did. I didn't do those kinds of things. Like, I love adventure, but that to me was so foreign.
But somehow, the idea stuck. Alex decided to reach out to the man leading the trip. His name is Scott Howe.
My first email was so overwhelming. So I had questions about the hockey, questions about the travel, questions about the tourism aspect. I mean, it was extensive.
Alex and Scott exchanged 74 emails, and Alex still had a lot of concerns. Here's one you might not think about, unless you're a hockey player.
So the game of hockey, a lot of people who enjoy it, they have a great sense of humor and they love, you know, it's called chirping and it's very playful banter. But I was under the impression that, you know, humor was going to be a no-go there. Be prepared to be questioned, you know, be on guard all of the time. Those kinds of things, if that makes sense.
On the other hand, this was the opportunity to play hockey against a national team. So he looked up some videos of his would-be competition on YouTube.
They were old, but I got a feel. I was like, okay, I can hang. I think we have a good shot here.
Alex says he wasn't really thinking about politics.
To me, the worst-case scenario was maybe something is said in the political arena that forces the borders to get shut and I get stuck in this country.
Alex decided to go, but he only told two people, and they're not the ones you might expect.
I did not tell my mom and dad.
As far as his family, his coworkers, and his beer league teammates knew, Alex was going on a tour of China, Beijing, Shanghai, and Hong Kong.
I mean, if there's any kids listening, like, this was bad of me. I would be grounded for this, for sure. But I remember having to Google things to do in Shanghai and Hong Kong, just in case people asked me. I could be like, oh yeah, I'm going to see this. It was an elaborate ruse. I know, I'm ashamed.
Alex landed in Pyongyang and breezed through customs. They didn't even look twice at the camera equipment he brought to document his trip, a gallon-sized Ziploc bag filled with his GoPro, extra batteries, and memory cards. In fact, everything went really smoothly until Alex's teammates arrived and 17 strangers had to figure out how to play hockey together.
We had a great range. We had one individual, I think it was his second time playing hockey ever. And I mean, talk about, you know, confidence. Not only are you willing to try a new sport, okay, but you're willing to try that new sport against a national team
in North Korea. Not long after that revelation, the North Korean team took to the ice for warm-ups. That's when Alex learned how out of date those YouTube videos had been.
Got out on the ice and I was watching them warm up, and they're all skating in one big circle, very, very fast. And then all of a sudden, someone just kind of yells like, "Hut!" And they all stop on a dime, and just snow ominously kicks up, all in unison. And I'm thinking to myself, like, okay, we are going to lose. I went to skate it over to Scott, and I was like, Scott, we are in some trouble. And he's like, oh, no, we'll be fine. Well, spoiler, we were not fine.
All right. Just played our first warm-up friendly game, and we got squashed. What was the final score? 16-1? Something, 16-15, 17. Get them next time.
Alex and his teammates did not get them next time. They lost every single game, and there were a lot of games.
We played about 6 hours a day, 3 in the morning, 3 in the evening. And in between then, we would tour all day. You know, it's nonstop.
Alex had only planned to use his GoPro during hockey games. He didn't think his tour guides would allow him to take videos outside the rink. But soon, he found himself taking it with him everywhere.
I'll admit, I was nervous. Even though they were telling me it was okay, I would always ask permission every time. Hey, can I film this? Can I film this? And they almost started getting annoyed with me because they kept being like, yeah, it's fine.
So Alex recorded his time in North Korea from the 3-lane bowling alley where he bowled with hotel staff. To the bus tours of Pyongyang and the surrounding countryside.
Please look at the building on your left. The building on your left is, what is it?
Train station.
Where we got it?
To the dinners, yes, where he and his teammates were entertained with live music.
Asian polka is the best way for me to describe it. But it's awesome.
One day, as the group was visiting Pyongyang's Hollywood-style movie studio, one of the tour guides, her name is Miss Lee, turned to Alex and said,
Alex, did you see what President Trump said? And I just am in my mind, I'm like, oh no. Oh no, what did he say? Please don't let him have said anything about North Korea. And I said, you know, no, Miss Lee, my phone doesn't work here. Like, I don't know. What did he say?
Turns out, at least on this day, the president hadn't said anything about North Korea. Miss Lee explained that she'd heard something about the U.S. maybe pulling out of a U.N. humanitarian council. She just wanted to know why. Nothing more ominous than that.
She wasn't trying to communicate anything outside of curiosity. Our tour guides especially were extremely curious about all things United States. They're curious just like I am, and they asked the same questions I would ask.
Alex Fraycon had traveled to North Korea to satisfy his curiosity, but he was also there to play hockey. The last game of the tournament was a mixed team scrimmage. The North Korean players took off their national team jerseys, and everyone put on the jerseys of the Friendship League. Alex says at that moment, the North Korean players, who had been serious and competitive, changed.
Immediately, I was approached by two players from the national team, and they just pointed, you know, one, two, and then at me, three. And they pointed to the ice. And I was like, okay, yeah, we just made a line right there. I think to them, it was like, okay, we're so much better than this kid. We're going to get him to score. Like, that's going to be our joy. So I got this really awesome cross-ice pass and caught this on my GoPro, obviously. I was just watching it. It was a beautiful pass. I kind of had this nice little semi-breakaway. and I shot it right into the goalie's pads.
Bad shot, bad shot.
And so I go back to the bench, and I sit next to a, you know, North Korean player, and I'm just shaking my head, and he's kind of looking at me. And I said, you know, my shot, and I motion with my stick, and then I hit my shin pad. I go, oh, I shot it right into his pads.
Bad shot, not no good. Yeah.
And without missing a beat, he kind of holds up his finger like, no, no, no. And he motions with his hand between his legs. No, no, no. Don't shoot it at the pads. Shoot it between the pads. He started laughing and I started laughing. But I realized, like, I just got chirped by a North Korean national hockey player.
After his flight back to Beijing, Alex had a more sobering task, telling his parents where he'd been.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear us?
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, let's get this over with.
So I made a slight change to my itinerary.
I'm nervous. I just said,
I was in North Korea the last week.
And then there was silence.
There was a long pause.
And I don't blame them.
Are you guys there?
Did they ever say anything?
I think the first thing my mom ended up saying was, well, that's a goofy thing to do.
The Friendship League is getting ready to go back to Pyongyang in March for another tournament against the North Korean national team. With the travel ban, it's no longer possible for U.S. citizens like Alex Fraycon to attend, even if they wanted to.
If, and I'll say if 50 more times, if I were to ever go back, I would have a full and lengthy discussion with my family beforehand. I love you, Mom and Dad. You're the best.
For Here and Now, I'm Karen Given.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. A new year has begun, and if you are setting new goals for your business, you need the right people on your team. And ZipRecruiter has transformed how you find them. ZipRecruiter posts your job to over 100 job boards with just one click, then actively looks for the most qualified candidates and invites them to apply. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Right now, listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Over the past few months, we've been learning that fake news is not the exclusive province of Macedonian teenagers or Russian hackers. From the Republican Governors Association to Congressman Devin Nunes, politicians and political groups have begun creating a parallel universe of websites where the news is always good for them and bad for their opponents. Joining us with more is Here and Now media analyst John Carroll. Hi there, John.
Hi, Magna.
Okay, so when we say a parallel universe, what exactly are we talking about? What do these sites look like?
Okay, so these are ads in sheep's clothing. They're basically designed to visually mirror news sites. They're named with names that sound like news sites. And so basically, at first glance, they look like your average news site.
Okay, great. So, but they're not, is what you're saying, right? So tell us what Congressman Devin Nunes has been up to then.
So Devin Nunes, who's also the House Intelligence Committee chairman, has set up recently this website called the California Republican. And it's filled with your standard issue GOP agitprop. The thing is that it's paid for by his campaign committee, but that's only listed at the very bottom of the homepage in really small type. Also, reverse type, so it's white on black, so it's even more illegible than it might otherwise be. Oh. So you can find out, but you have to work pretty hard to see what this is exactly.
I gotcha. Now, I understand also that the site is listed on Facebook as a media news company.
Right, and I don't know if they submitted that designation or if Facebook did it through its algorithm. Either way, it provides a legitimacy for them that it doesn't really deserve.
Okay, and also may have an influence on where the articles show up in someone's Facebook feed.
Oh, absolutely.
Who knows? Now, there's another website, the Free Telegraph, which is produced by the Republican Governors Association.
Right. And they don't have any disclosure on their homepage. So that's a website that basically puffs up Republican governors and bashes Democratic governors. They originally had a disclosure on their homepage. They just recently moved it to the individual story pages at the very bottom, saying, well, that's where the majority of readers go. But very few of those readers make it to the end of the article where they would find out that this is just campaign marketing.
Okay. But to the point about most people go directly to articles versus the homepage, the RGA is right about that, though. The clicks do go to individual articles. You're just saying that people don't read to the
end. Right, right. Okay. So you're talking about a very small number of people who know actually what they're reading.
Okay. So this is interesting, because so we're talking about this in a political context right now, but it seems like something similar has been happening in the private sector for a long time. Like, I was just looking at the New York Times homepage, and, you know, they've got a whole section of things that look like New York Times articles, or even produced by the T Brand Studio, whose goal is to create multimedia articles that could be taken for Times journalism. Point, though, like, I'm looking at one from Intel, and it does say at the top, paid for by Intel.
Right.
But it's supposed to look like journalism.
Right. It's called native advertising. It mirrors the content around it, the editorial content around it. And it's all about disclosure. If you disclose, then, you know, you're playing pretty much by the rules. The less you disclose, the more people think it's editorial content, the more you're deceiving the reader.
Okay, so by telling the truth, you're making it less effective is what
exactly,
you're saying.
Exactly. Okay. It's a tug of war between the advertisers and the publishers.
Huh. Now, have we seen any similar efforts by the Democratic Party?
I have not, although I'm guessing that we probably will before too long, but so far I have not.
Well, John Carroll is media analyst for Here and Now and a journalism professor at Boston University. We've got a link to his Campaign Outsider blog at hereandnow.org. John, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Got some quick headlines from the Winter Olympics. Canada and Germany tied for the gold medal in two-man bobsledding. It's the second dead heat in this event in history. Both pairs finished with the time of 3 minutes, 16.86 seconds, so down to the hundredth of a second there. The International Olympic Committee says a Russian athlete, a curler, has failed a doping test. The president of the Russian Curling Federation says someone may have spiked Alexander Krushelnitsky's food or drink because he tested clean less than a month ago. Krushelnitsky and his wife won a bronze medal in the mixed curling doubles. And American Michaela Schifrin will not ski in the downhill event on Wednesday. She says she wants to focus on the alpine combined event on Thursday. So let's turn now to the sport of mountaineering, but jump back about a century, because in 1895, 45-year-old Annie Smith Peck of Providence, Rhode Island, was named by the New York Times as the third woman ever to summit the Matterhorn in the Swiss Alps. She was the first woman to do it in pants. Peck was known as the Queen of the Climbers, and she was also a scholar and a suffragette. A young fan of hers, one Amelia Earhart, said she, quote, felt like an upstart compared to Miss Peck. Well, Hannah Kimberly is an author of the first ever biography of Annie Smith Peck. It's called A Woman's Place is at the Top, and I spoke with Hannah recently. How did you first hear of Annie Smith Peck, and why did you want to write about her?
Well, my dad actually found a poster of her in an antique shop, and he'd said, A Woman's Place is at the Top, hence the title of the book. And it said that she was a mountain climber and a suffragist and an expert on North-South American relations. And he said, it reminded me of you. Oh. So he brought it home, and I ended up writing a book about her.
What a cool thing for your dad to do. Okay, so let's tell a little story then about Annie Smith Peck, because we talked about her summiting the Matterhorn a second ago. But you have a story in the book about how she became the first woman to climb what was then thought to be one of the highest peaks in the Western Hemisphere.
Right. That's Mount Huascarán in Peru. So at the time, a lot of these mountains were unclimbed. They were virgin peaks. So she was sort of searching for the highest peak, or what might be the highest peak that had been unclimbed by any man or woman. And she read in the footnote of a book that Huascarán might be the highest peak in the Western Hemisphere. And so she set out to climb it.
All right. Well, can you read a little excerpt then? This is from A Woman's Place is at the Top.
Sure. In the frigid temperatures, one of the Swiss guide's hands and one of his feet developed blood-filled, purplish blisters that turned hard and black as his muscles, blood vessels, and nerves had frozen without proper protection. He was frostbitten so badly that eventually he would have to have most of his left hand, a finger on his right, and half of his foot amputated. The trek down was less than celebratory. Nonetheless, the American leader of the expedition quietly felt a sense of satisfaction at finally conquering the mountain after 5 long years, on the 6th attempt, at the age of 58. Her name was Annie Smith Peck.
Wow. That's an excerpt from A Woman's Place is at the Top, a biography of Annie Smith Peck, Queen of the Climbers. She was a 19th century mountaineer and suffragette. And we'll get to the suffragette part in just a second. But how is it that that Peck first got into mountaineering? It doesn't seem like a very common pastime for the 19th century.
Well, it was. She started vacationing with her family in the Adirondacks. And so they were sort of, you know, these city slickers who had gone into the wilderness and would climb around a bit there. But she first got the bug when she was traveling in Europe, and she saw that people were climbing the Matterhorn. Mm. But she didn't have the $50 to rent the equipment and the guide, so she promised herself that she would go back. And she ended up going back 10 years later in 1895 when she was 45.
So she started her mountaineering career at the age of 45?
Exactly.
Wow. Right. Okay. So she's quite an unusual person. And was, I mean, she before that she had been, what, lecturing and teaching at Smith?
Right. She did a year at Smith and 2 years at Purdue University. But she found out pretty much that, this is going to sound so strange, Meghna, but she was not making the same amount of money as her male counterparts.
I'm shocked.
So she set off to be a lecturer. And then realized once she started lecturing on her Matterhorn climb that people became more interested.
Okay. So on that Matterhorn ascent, we quoted the New York Times, right, saying that she was the third woman ever to do the summit and the first in pants.
Right, right. And she actually wasn't even the third. There were plenty more women before her. But the scandalous part was that she was wearing pants because most women climbers at the time climbed in long skirts or dresses.
Now, this is no offense to Annie Smith Peck, because climbing any mountain is an accomplishment. But it seems like at first blush, I was like, wow, it might have been even harder to do it in skirts.
Definitely. So. And that's exactly what she said. It's just too risky to be climbing in a skirt.
You know. So she said it was too risky. Okay, because I was wondering, because you write how she was a suffragette as well. Was she trying to make a political statement by wearing pants, or was this purely like, I need to get to the top safely?
Exactly. She just didn't want to break her neck, she said.
Okay. But she became very famous for her mountaineering triumphs.
She did, and she used that to her advantage. She was on a series of trading cards titled The World's, you know, Famous Explorers, with 24 men and then Annie. She went out, her images went out with every Singer sewing machine that was sold in 1910.
No kidding.
Yeah, to sort of inspire women, pumping away at the treadle of their Singer sewing machines. And she used it to her advantage. So she'd get to the top of a peak and plant a banner that, you know, read Votes for Women.
Wow.
So she used it in terms of the suffragist movement.
Okay. And did she play sort of a further role in the suffragette movement, aside from using her fame to advance awareness of it?
She did. And she also participated in politics before women had the right to vote. So she was hired, for example, by Woodrow Wilson's political presidential campaign. And she stumped for him and did lots of speeches that sort of packed the halls of these men that would come to see this mountain climber speaking on behalf of Wilson. Hmm. So she participated in politics as well as wrote loads and loads of articles and editorials about the suffrage movement.
Yeah. So, you know, back to the actual mountaineering that she did. It seems like she climbed in Europe and in North and South America a lot.
Yes.
So no one really ever does any of those peaks, well, I guess especially in the 19th century, alone. Was she often the only woman?
She was always the only woman.
And so how did that work out for her? Were there, you know, I don't want to say power struggles, but did the male climbers take her seriously?
There were power struggles between her and her guides and also her porters. You know, they'd get finished, you know, a long day of climbing, and she would still be expected to cook. So it was hard for them, I think, to take orders from a woman. But she would always stand up for herself and say, you know, I hired you. I can fire you. We're going. We're doing this. So there were some, you know, times of mutiny with her crews, definitely.
Wow.
Where she had to turn back because they said, we can't go any farther.
Right. Okay. Because you really don't want your team to fall apart when you're at 20,000 feet. Or
exactly.
Something like that.
Exactly.
Oh, tough. Okay. So I understand that she kept climbing until her 80s. Is that right?
She did. Her last peak was in the presidential range at age 82, but she had slowed down before that. But when she was 80, she took a 20,000-mile tour on the first commercial flights around South America. So think like no runways with the leather hat on, like Amelia Earhart. So she did that when she was 80. So flew over the mountains instead of climbing on them, and then wrote a book about that.
These indefatigable, adventurous women. Love it. So scholar, suffragette, mountain summiter, sounds like a pretty impressive legacy here. Why is it that you think more people don't know about Annie Smith Peck?
Well, she never married, and there really wasn't any family members left to sort of carry on her legacy, although she hired a biographer, and he just couldn't garner any interest in her, in a biography of her. There's a great letter that I found that says, you know, there's no interest in a biography of her at the time, and that letter was on August 1st, and this book, my book, came out on August 1st. Wow. So it was a nice sort of full circle moment.
Well, Hannah Kimberly righted a historical wrong when she became the author of the first ever biography of Annie Smith Peck. It's called A Woman's Place is at the Top. When Congress returns from its recess next week, it'll have just days to do something about the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. That's the Obama-era program that prevents the deportation of some young immigrants who were brought to the country illegally as children. DACA expires on March 5th, and lawmakers are split over what to do about it. But when you pull back, how much does immigration more broadly actually divide Americans? Derek Thompson has been looking at why immigration seems so controversial, and he joins us from New York, as he does each Monday. Hi there, Derek.
Hello.
Okay, so when we're talking about immigration more broadly and how it divides or doesn't divide Americans, are we talking about all of immigration, or DACA specifically help focus us?
Sure. Let's take both these issues, DACA and then immigration more broadly. DACA might be controversial in Washington, but it's not controversial as an issue across the country. Between 80 and 90% of Americans, that's about as close to a majority or a supermajority or unison as you can possibly get, say that the U.S. should protect, should do its best to protect these children brought to the U.S. When they were young and illegal immigrants then. So I think there's clearly a consensus on that issue among the public, even if there's not a consensus in Washington. Now, on the broader issue of immigration, what's interesting is that if you look at the polling, Americans in general are more positive on immigration maybe than they've ever been. I found two polls, one by Gallup, one by Pew, each said that immigrants, that the share of Americans saying that immigrants strengthen the country or help the economy reached its highest point in 2017 in the history of polling. That's mostly because Democrats have gone so far to the left over the last few years, and particularly under Donald Trump on this issue. So when you pull back and you look at immigration as it polls, rather than as it cleaves Democrats from Republicans in Washington, you're really looking at an historic moment for its popularity.
Okay, but as if I understand you correctly, as you're saying, though, it's largely partisan, though. It's because of Democratic changes in or increase in support for immigration.
Yeah, I think it's important to say that Republican support for immigration fell a little bit in 2006 and has mostly remained in the 30s, 40s. If you ask Republicans and Democrats, do you think immigration strengthens the economy? They used to be actually relatively similar between, say, you know, the 90s and 2006. And then since 2006, they've really cleaved, with Democrats moving far to the left on the issue of immigration and Republicans sort of staying relatively low on the issue.
Okay, so in 2006, then what happened to cause this particular cleavage?
Yeah, so I'm not exactly, you know, without being able to talk to, you know, millions of Americans, I can't have a perfect idea of what's going through their head. But there's a pretty big thing that happened in 2006, which is likely to be the event that forked the parties. That's George W. Bush's attempt to pass comprehensive immigration reform.
Right.
And what seems to have happened is that the Republican House's attempt to write a bill in 2006 essentially tried to criminalize illegal immigration in a way that really radicalized Democrats. And then there was a conservative backlash to the radicalization of Democrats in 2006. And then, right, you saw immigration sort of become a wedge issue in a way that it hadn't been for the previous few years. And since then, the forking has really just continued, with Democrats moving further and further and further to the left in the issue, and Republicans essentially digging in their heels and saying, you know, a majority of this party is going to be in some way against the immigration issue. And then obviously you have President Donald Trump starting his campaign in 2015 saying that illegal Mexican immigrants are bringing drugs, bringing crime, they're rapists, et cetera.
Right. You know, I mean, forthcoming Democrats will say that they possibly weren't speaking clearly or passionate enough about security, border security, at the same time that they were talking about immigration reform in that 2006 period. But on the, you know, on the other side, there is a divide, as you write, within the Republican Party itself. You describe it as ICE versus INC. What do you mean?
Right. ICE, I-C-E versus INC, I-N-C, like incorporated. Essentially, I think that there's a Trump wing of the party and a Koch brothers Chamber of Commerce wing of the party. On the one hand, you've got the Trump wing of the party, which is extremely critical of immigration, that not only wants to make life more difficult for the Dreamers, but also then to lower legal levels of immigration and crack down harder on undocumented workers through ICE, the Immigration Customs an enforcement agency. And then on the other hand, you have these Republicans, you know, Paul Ryan, the Koch brothers, Chamber of Commerce, that are more Randian, more corporate libertarian in their beliefs, and say, look, we should let in more immigrants, not only to grow the tent of the Republican Party in the Hispanic community, but also because immigrants from Latin America tend to be cheaper workers, arguably, and cheaper workers make life easier on corporate profits.
Yeah.
And so within the Republican Party, I think this is a misunderstood issue. You really have this this robust debate between the Trump wing and the Koch brothers wing, such that, you know, Trump is the president. But remember who got all the money in the Republican primary, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, maybe even in the 2020 primaries, if Trump is primaried himself.
Yeah, it's hard to see, though, how a debate between extremes yields anything but an extreme though.
Indeed.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Megan Chakrabarty. Jeremy Hobson is back tomorrow. This is Here and Now.